Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Jim Boyer, and he will be speaking on spiritual wholeness and intimacy. So let's listen in on Jim Boyer.
We have been looking at spirituality at the center, which is a concept out of a book we'll look at again today called Finding God at Home, Family Life as Spiritual Discipline by Ernest Boyer. No relation to myself, but good book to know about. And he explicates in this book two different kinds of spirituality, what he calls a spirituality at the center, that is of our close everyday relationships. He talks about the sacred of the sacrament of the routine and the sacrament of caring for one another as the two kinds of sacred activities that go into that realm of spirituality. He contrasts that with a spirituality of the edge, is what he calls, which has to do more with a sort of being inspired as an individual and moving in an inspired way into the world to make some change or follow some deeply felt mission. Now, he doesn't set that up as a duality, as if one's better or one's worse. In fact, he suggests that we all have within us somewhat of a tension between those two kinds of spirituality, and the need to find our own fulfillment and our own inspired vocations, for instance, or contribution to life, which may include for a period of time marriage, or that can be an aspect of that spirituality, raising children. So there's that tension between spirituality at the edge, spirituality at the center. What we're focusing on, and next week we'll go into parent-child relationships, in which we look at the parenting task more specifically as it ties into this the spirituality at the center, which basically means just seeing what we do in our families and our close relationships as part of, not separate from, our spiritual life and our connection with God. And so that's what we're looking at. Okay, is that helpful? And the other topics we've looked at this week so far was just a kind of a general overview, and then looking at gender differences, which the fundamental thing there that I take with that is just that gender, or gender difference, which is a fundamental biological difference, is probably our deepest and most profound education in dealing with difference generally, and what a challenge that is for us at many levels, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, so that gender is just, to me, it's just a note of how to deal with difference, whether that's culturally or if we look at the Myers-Briggs categories, or whatever, however we, you know, define ourselves and understand ourselves as different human beings. We certainly do well to call for God's grace in dealing with that, and that's part of the reframe for that is seeing that as richness versus like judgment, or, you know, I'm certain ways, so my wife's, because she doesn't think that way, you know, isn't correct, or that sort of a thing. And then we had another session on being what we called soulmates, which had to do with some of the practices of attending to our spiritual lives, and we're using soul and spirituality in somewhat of a synonymous form. So what it means to kind of be together in that, and we'll talk more about that today in terms of spiritual practices. But that doesn't mean, you know, we see things from the same perspective. It just means that there's in the close relationship an awareness of one spiritual being, and that there is a way to dialogue about that.
And do you have these other two
on tape? Yeah, those are on tape, right, yeah. Someone had told me, however, that I hadn't realized in Holden they put music on the tapes, and sometimes that obscures the dialogue a little bit, so if you could be patient, apparently it comes through a bit, but it's just a little, can be hard to read, so, or to listen to, I mean, so. I went fishing yesterday. That was my day off, so I wasn't there yesterday. But our fourth session had to do with maintaining vitality within a relationship We look particularly at Harville Hendrix and in his book, Getting the Love You Want, which is a very popular book now, but is one of the few marriage books that really does tie in the spirituality aspect and directs us to look at particularly our own process. And the big point we were making with that is that when we look at spirituality and close relationships from the asking the question, what do we do to keep it alive, then the very important fundamental conclusion is that we work on our own growth and our own vitality. And that as we are vital, growing persons, then we, and connected with the source of our own inner vitality, then we participate in a resourcing and valuable way in close relationships.
On that, I have a line here on your, one of yours that you said, spiritual movement has a lot to do with humility.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I like that.
You like that line? Yeah. It's... which is, when we look at ourselves, you know, and that's one thing about a close relationship, it will show us who we are more clearly than we'd ever seen. I sometimes say with the couples I work with, and I'm a pastoral counselor full-time, so and specialize in marriage and family therapy, so I work with a lot of couples, and it always strikes me how... you know, how living with someone, they'll develop a much more objective view of ourselves as individuals, you know, than we really can develop ourselves. It's one of the blessings and burdens of being married, I think, or living with someone over time. My wife, who happens to be with us today, Chris, is here, hello, has a much clearer view of my family and my process and blind spots, etc., than I do, so... But humility, yeah, is part of that, and that's a very useful aspect. Which leads us to our discussion today, which will focus basically on the business of what we call spiritual wholeness, which whenever we say it that way, we have to be very careful that we don't see that as like a goal or a final accomplishment, but rather as a process. And I actually got a definition for you, which might be helpful. I would suggest that spiritual wholeness is a lifelong journey or process emanating from the soul, meaning the life force within us or our God image within us, emanating from the soul's hunger for union with God, resulting in an ever-increasing seeing and relating to self and others through God's eyes. Let me read that again. Spiritual wholeness, I understand as a lifelong journey or process emanating from our soul's hunger for union with God, meaning a coming back or a discovery in our own lives practically of what it means to be created in God's image, resulting in an ever-increasing seeing and relating to self and others through God's eyes. Which is quite a thing to be about. But I think one general thing, if we could focus on one thing, I think it's how close relationships give us an opportunity to discover how we don't see ourselves and others through God's eyes, and to work on that in a lifelong way. Again, understanding that that's never totally accomplished, but that we move towards that understanding and appreciating that our experiences of brokenness or hurts will cause us to be sort of blinded or blurred in terms of that fully loving, deeply appreciating, and unconditionally accepting view of God. So that's sort of the image, and it's nothing like a practical challenge to be living with another human being or working towards that. That's what we want to talk about today. Grid that I've offered on the board here has to do with just one model of spiritual wholeness, and again, it's a process that we're talking about. And this is from a book that's good to know about. It's written for clergy, pretty much. I've got a bag of books here for us. It's called Spiritual Wholeness for Clergy, A New Psychology of Intimacy with God, Self, and Others. And this is written by Donald Hands and Wayne Fair, who have worked with over 400 clergy persons in a retreat setting, many with different kinds of symptoms, but often in some kind of a midlife crisis in their lives, in which they are drawn back to the whole process of spiritual growth and re-anchoring their own spirituality in a more functional way. One of my friends in college said, when he learned I was going into the ministry, he says, "Oh, now you're going to be a professional Christian," which sort of gets at one of the paradoxes of professional Christians or church professionals, and that is how, you know, the unique challenges of being spiritual leaders, but also attending to their own spirituality. This is a wonderful book. Some bishops are buying it for the whole synod, all the clergy in their group. And it's good. It'd be, I think, very helpful to look at just for first for the model that he works with, which roughly is put out here, which has to do with different levels of intimacy. These are all levels of intimacy. Intimacy being understood as a fuller knowledge of oneself, or a more complete or deep knowledge of self. Starts with self-knowledge, which is also an important level of spiritual wholeness, because it will always lead us to an expanding and ever-increasingly deep understanding of ourselves. Someone has said that marriage is for life, because a lifetime is certainly not long enough to know another person, adding that it's certainly not long enough to understand and fully appreciate the mystery of ourself either. Spirituality, as we attend to our experience in the world and relationship to God, will tend to continue to lift out periods of growth, stability, but then lead us into a more and more depth discovery of ourself. Leading then, and as a foundation, is really what this model suggests, is self-intimacy is a foundation for interpersonal intimacy, and then is supported, and it doesn't lead necessarily, but is supported and reflected in what we call spiritual intimacy, which would be that sense, again, of seeing ourselves through God's eyes more and more accurately as His child, someone infinitely valuable, deeply mysterious and wonderful, and a being whom God relates to with tremendous interest and compassion. Now, part of the struggle here, of course, is we come into the world with not necessarily people relating to us with God's eye. Certainly, all our parents had that intention at some level, but life is difficult. Freud says the first trauma of life is the birth trauma. We're carried around by our mothers and then all of a sudden have to begin to learn to do life on our own. The limitations of family life, etc., will always leave, I think, a residue within our spirit that we needed more love than we got, and it's kind of a hungering for more, which I think sets in our heart and our spirit that hungering for God's all-embracing compassion. Now, of course, sometimes we would begin to look for that in another person or a close relationship. But it's the it's then the spirit's journey back to a connection with God and understanding that God in His good fathering and mothering of us is really the ultimate source for understanding ourselves as a child of God, fully understood, fully appreciated. And then our interpersonal relationships, as we move this way, it comes back as we experience this being a child of God, and the affirmation and the support and the inspiration that provides. Then we move back into our personal realm with new inspiration, new resource, empowerment to love as we have been loved. And beyond, really, and I think this is the overcoming the recreative side of spiritual growth, is we're able to do that even beyond what we have been given or what we've been seeing, let's say, in our specific individual histories. I think that's the real miraculous process of spiritual life within close relationships, is that we become conduits of divine love and reincarnations of divine love, even beyond our natural capacities, as we continue to root in that love in our lives, in certain ways.
I agree that the spiritual is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And but I think that husband and wives forget that they need to have a personal relationship outside of their children.
Yeah.
I mean, these parents go on and their children are around them all the time. They've got to get away from their children periodically so that they know each other.
Yeah.
So when their kids leave home, they still have this wonderful relationship.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a good point. It's often observed that marriages get lost in the dust of diapers, programs, etc. And that gives me a chance to note in our culture, you know, the focus on marriage and family, particularly marriage, I think, it's certainly not a brand new thing, but it is, I think it's recalling us as a society that says, marriage isn't disposable, or it isn't an air fern that just grows out of nothing. How do we keep in touch over time, and how easy it is to let that an adequate level of attention kind of drop below the line. And of course, nobody can prescribe that for us. I mean, this again is all about our own journeys and our own particular relationships. What's enough time? But points well taken that demands a family life or of work. I mean, that's another typical competitor to nurturing a close relationship. Can get in the way.
A lot of men are only married to one thing, their job.
This has been documented. It can be a problem, definitely. Now, so there's that. You raised the issue too of active wellness of close relationships, just like our bodies. Gerald May in his book Care of Mind, Care of Spirit. A lot of authors talk about the active wellness. Scott Peck in Road Less Traveled really emphasized that wellness is something actively achieved and not passively received. And that's this certainly applies to close relationships. Okay, this paradigm here is just one way to look at the different aspects. And the polarities there have to do with maximum power, which can be a kind of a funny word we use in terms of spirituality, and yet that is the power of God's image and God's spirit working through us to be all that we can be, to realize our creative potentials, and also maximum relationship. So the quadrant of growth that these authors suggest that spiritual wholeness moves towards is this quadrant here, moves in this direction, towards maximum power, maximum relationship. So we don't just, we're just by ourselves having a good spiritual experience, but we feed ourselves spiritually, which moves us into relatedness, certainly both in terms of individual intimacy, but then also in the community and the larger world also. These other quadrants are different kinds of combinations and the authors would say imbalances, where you have maximum relationship with minimum power. They talk about religious addiction or fundamentalism, where everything has to do with God doing everything in the world, and that we are really we're not very capable of doing anything. We just try to stay out of God's way. That's sort of an idea. Here, minimum relationship and minimum power would have to do with what they call reverse pride, which says, I'm so terrible. See the self in this quadrant and say, I'm so terrible, I'm not good for anybody else, or I'm not good for God either, and I'm so bad, in fact, that God cannot forgive me or work with me, which is, at some level, kind of an escape from the challenges of spiritual wholeness, which have to do with empowerment and engagement into life. Then this quadrant here has to do with an unrootedness, or he looks at this with clergy particularly, because sometimes clergy may learn a style of leadership that is charismatic, and sometimes can develop a cult of personality, as we say, but this is unrooted in identity as child of God, and it would lead towards what he says calls a spiritual bankruptcy. Which just is another way to say we can still be about wonderful things, but if we're not actively attending to our own spirituality, then the rootedness in that, the flow of love and compassion will dry up, and we'll have some difficulty then in actually functionally being present in a way that is nurturing in our close relationships. So maximum power. Which some of the traditional models, you know, the leader-follower model of close relationships said one person had the power, you know, but the other one had to follow. And here's where we get with maximum power in the interpersonal realm. We get a sense of a two-power system, a true democracy. Each person's point of view counts, and building out of that model. Maximum relationship has to do with doing what it takes to understand the different persons in a close relationship, and yeah, that takes energy and time and effort to do that. As does our spiritual life. And all this talk, you know, we don't want to just add things to your calendar, you know, morning of prayer, and or an hour of prayer in the morning, hour of talking with my husband or wife, you know, in the evening. But there is some, I think, some real ramifications for, you know, exploring what our lifestyle reflects in terms of some attention to this. And this is just a time to try to stir our thoughts you know, kind of review what are some of those things that we're doing individually more as we're talking today, but then also in the relationship that puts the energy in a place that will open to what's already there, and that is God's interest in us, and then how that flows into our relationship. Any questions about that? That's just one model to look at and consider. Okay. Well, close relationships then, as we're saying, will give us a flavor of the divine, or reflect the divine in our life. And one way to describe that would be a section from Thomas More's Soulmates, Honoring the Mysterious of Love Relationship. And we've looked at this along the way a little bit. And let's see what he says about that particular experience. He says, the soul of a relationship doesn't ask for the right ways of acting. It wants something even more difficult, respect for its autonomy and mystery. The soulful relationship asks to be honored for what it is, not for what we wish it could be. So here he's getting at all the expectations that we bring into a relationship, again, moving from fantasy to what really is there in a relationship or isn't. It has little to do with intentions, expectations, or moral requirements. It has the potential to lead us into the mysteries that expand our hearts and transform our thoughts. But it can't do that when our primary interest is in pursuing our cherished ideologies of love, family, marriage, and community. The point in a relationship is not to make us feel good, but to lead us into a profound alchemy of soul, or process of soul, that reveals to us many of the pathways and openings that are the geography of our own destiny and potentiality. Very philosophical language to basically say we are in relationship to discover the mysteries of our own growth and the growth of our partner, and that an openness and expectancy of that process is what's soulful about close relationships. So, and he's really talking here against, you know, all the expectations that we have, which includes, of course, gender expectations, roles of wife and husband, and those sorts of things. He says soul will always kind of push against those expectations in a way that, I mean, they may meet the expectations or the wide definitions, the widely held definitions, but it may not too, and so soul invites an openness to that. He says further, every relationship that touches the soul leads us into a dialogue with eternity. so that even though we may think our strong emotions focus on the people around us, we are being set face to face with divinity itself, however we understand or speak that mystery. The Sufi woman poet Rabia bint Ka'b says, "Love, an ocean with invisible shores, with no shores. If you are wise, you will not swim in it." So this is, again, how one way to just articulate the mystery, that our close relationships bring us also into encounter with the divine, meaning someone who's moving towards us with interest and compassion, and also who's asking for that kind of relatedness on a deep intimacy level also. And he goes on to say, we all seem to be sort of, you know, have a hunger for that. Then he says that we can let unplanned developments happen, allow people to change, tolerate our own idiosyncratic needs and cravings, and enjoy and appreciate a community of individuals who may think differently than we do, live oddly, and express themselves none too rationally. For this is what relationship is about, the discovery of the multitude of ways soul is incarnate in this world. He said, for this is what relationship is about, the discovery of the multitude of ways soul is incarnate in this world. And again, it's a close relationship that gets us most involved in that with another specific human being and their divine incarnation. Our own is amazing enough. What better expresses the point of human life than engagement with this soul, with its manifest and hidden qualities, its mysterious alchemies and transformation and transformative pieties? If we can find the whole world in a grain of sand, we can also find the soul itself at the small point of life where destinies cross and hearts intermingle. That's Thomas More emphasizing for us the discovery of our encounter with God in the interpersonal, and again how that is happening on two different levels at the same time. So when we talk about our spiritual life or the ways that we work on our connection with God, I think it's important to see how that's all connected and look at ways that we might do that. In that regard, I showed you this early in the week. Let me go back to Sam Keen's Hymn of an Unknown God, Hymns to an Unknown God, Awakening the Spirit in Everyday Life, a fairly new book. But he's got an interesting set of what he calls rituals for consecrating our days, a sample of rituals for living. And when we look at the tradition of spirituality, there's just a couple of things that come up in terms of spiritual work. The basic things you keep hearing again and again are time for reflection and prayer, attending to your own spiritual emotional process, which may include journaling or sharing your inner life with another person. And a third area would be connecting with another human being in terms of sharing that process, which formally is called spiritual direction, which is a ministry that our Catholic sisters and brothers have done for a long time. They meet regularly with a spiritual guide, and the guide doesn't tell them what God is telling them or direct their lives. The guide just listens to their spiritual process and reflects what they hear and raises maybe some themes or some, and maybe makes suggestions for their meditative life. So those three things, sharing your spiritual life with another person, a prayerful dialogue with God, in times of reflectivity, are the key kinds of behaviors. Of course, in our busy lives, again, what do we get into? We get into patterns of doing what we have to. And one thing I think Holden provides a context in which to slow down. But we sort of get busy around here, though, too. So you know, it's kind of a paradox. Another paradox I've run into is the staff. Boy, they are really busy. You know, these young folks are working their little tails off, it seems to me. But and it seems also, though, that they really plug into the devotional life, certainly, and have times of reflection. So it's an interesting mix, and I think it reflects the mix that we all live with in our life. Do what we need to do, but also create enough time for spiritual renewal. And here's just some examples. Sam Keen is someone who studied for the ministry. He went into writing and teaching, I believe as a sociologist, or he's also deep into psychology. But he writes with, I think, a good sensitivity to spiritual wellness. And in a way that sometimes, you know, the unchurched, I think, often are able to hear and to pick up. Some of his suggestions, he says, symbols, rituals, and gestures. He has a section there. He says an inspired mind is, meaning inspirited mind, is a metaphoric mind in which everything is both itself and a symbol pointing beyond itself. To play with ritual and to invent disciplines of awareness is to recognize that we have dual citizenship. We live simultaneously in two dimensions, the profane and the sacred, time and eternity. Something we hear a lot about, but how often do we let ourselves listen to the eternal theme in a week at Holden, for instance, or in a special day we experienced, or in a just a regular day, and let the theme or the word or the feeling emerge from the depths of ourselves just by listening. Talks about simmering in the art of dreaming. Said, my friend and sometime guide on the path, Howard Thurman, once advised me, when you wake up in the morning, never get out of bed, simmer. And when you go to bed at night, never go to sleep, simmer. Ancient shamans and aborigines, no less than Freud, remind us that the dream is the royal road to the unconscious. They knew that we can weave together the tattered edges of our visible and invisible reality only if we cultivate the ability to travel in and out of dream time. Whole, you know, discipline of journaling and things like that. Has anybody journaled their dreams? Done that at any during period of their life? It's an interesting experience, and the theory behind that, of course, is that our unconscious mind, which is roughly synonymous with our soul activity. I think soul goes through all our layers of consciousness, but if we appreciate that our unconscious mind deals with the poetic and the symbolic, I mean, totally, see? And that our dreams are always about ourselves, no matter if Uncle George or the Pope or... I had a dream with Ronald Reagan in it once, and I had a tough time to figure that one out. But it's all about our own process and how the drama or the story emerging in the dream is ourselves doing something with our experience, searching for, not necessarily understanding, but just giving ourselves reflection in terms of our own experience and growth. So he says simmer. You got to have simmering time. Before bed is good. Early in the morning is good. The technical terms for those times are hypnopompic times. When we're getting up in the morning, and hypnagogic time when we're going to bed, and we really do sink into a subconscious zone that often we've all had the experience where we have insights or awarenesses at those times, and it's I think a particularly soulful time that may be useful to certainly remind ourselves of. He says, just more on that, to recover the fullness of spirit, we need to live in continuous intercourse with our dreams and develop a love affair between the radically different selves we are in sleeping and waking. In dreams, I contain a community of saints and libertines, fools and wise animals, kindly and cruel men and women. I am the hero I admire and the enemy I hate. To one awakening to the wisdom of the night, it is obvious that self-love and love for others' neighbor are heads and tails of the same coin. A similar point. I am those others whom I love and despise. We only hate most deeply what we don't accept in ourselves, and that's another appreciation for the soul's process. is that it will lead us to our hatreds, which are signals of other aspects of ourselves that perhaps are unintegrated or that we're working on. And he talks about kairotic and chronic and chronos as time. We may be familiar with that. Scripture is very clear about kairotic time. In the fullness of time, God sent Jesus Christ into the world. This is language of the soul also, where there's a time to talk and to share. And he makes a lot about, in our church schedules, expecting a blessing from the Holy Spirit on Sunday morning at 11 or even 8:30 may be more unrealistic. But the way that we schedule in things, which again is a paradox, we need to set time apart and therefore a schedule. But in kairotic time, there's more of a sense of our readiness to receive. Perhaps we've all heard some of the best sermons ever written, but if we weren't in place to receive that, it may have bounced off us not stuck. So he talks about celebrations and personal holy days. Interesting section here. He uses a quote from a film, A Thousand Clowns, that says you have got to own your days and name them, each one of them, every one of them, or else the years go right by and none of them belongs to you. And so he says here he gives us a sampler of his celebrations. He has a lilac day. He says contrary to those who order us to go on daylight savings time, spring is not ushered in by the clock. So it's a could be a Holden Lake wildflower day, I suppose. A friend's day, a money day. Sometime, usually around April 15, I find it is a good idea to measure my life goals against the wherewithal to accomplish them. Morning day, he says, each November 4th since 1964, I stop for a while to remember the day my father died and to allow myself to be sad that death has established its domain over so many of my family and friends. And of course, this happens naturally, as we all know, in terms of our deep losses, that the anniversary, which we may not be conscious of, will grab us in some way. And
is he speaking about
visions? Let's see, where does he go with this? He does talk about eternal moments, but those are more times when we lose ourselves. Inactivity or blissful things. I had one yesterday, fly fishing, as a matter of fact, where I took my, brought a float tube along, which was kind of cumbersome to bring here, which isn't totally kosher for wilderness, but I brought it up and just floating there in the water, feeling the support in that and fishing away, lost conscious sense, and it was really enjoyable for a time. But visions would, tell me more about what you're thinking. That would be like a vision in a dream, or perhaps a vision that just persists?
A vision in a certain instant.
Gotcha.
Does that have to do with what your soul is feeling, or your soul is wanting, or asking for?
That's the question of searching about that would be the spiritual wholeness process. You see, I've had this experience. And I've got a pastoral counselor colleague up in Seattle. Some of you, anybody from Seattle? He's the director, in fact, of the Presbyterian Counseling Service on the Ravina. And he says people are aching to talk about those kind of spiritual experiences. They're experiences with God that often there isn't forums easily available to talk about that. And I think, yes, I think we get visions.
I think something that people do experience.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And it's not,
why do people not want to talk about it?
Well, I think particularly Lutherans or mainline denomination folks, there's a real... there's a suspicion of the unconscious, of the soul. We're, as a society, we have emphasized a conscious rationality for so many years, which is important. But this whole dialogue talks about a balance between the rational and what we've identified as the irrational, which is actually the emotional, our body sense, our spiritual visions. And it's also a distrust of the poetic, or the symbolic, which is how visions often come to us. We get a sense of, say, a certain animal or a certain word or a certain song that hits us in a certain way. And these would all count as spiritual experiences. That Keene, I think, also says that, you know, the REM, the rapid eye movement, happens every 90 minutes, okay? He says that happens both when we're asleep as well as when we're awake. So we're having dream states of some sort, you know, every 90 minutes. I don't know where our rhythms are as a group, but you guys are talking here. One of us is in, probably is in a REM, a dream place, which would give rise to daydreams. We talk about that. Or perhaps that would be a time when we would remember, say, a friend, and remember to write a note to a friend. See, that interconnectedness would be all part of that. And it's kind of it takes us away from the specifics of the moment or the conscious task we're about, and gives us a larger perspective. It's not uncommon. And, we distinguish this, of course, from thought disorder or hallucinations, where that would be a more specific kind of situation with usually hearing voices or something like that. But visions, spiritual visions, have been around for generations and across cultures too. But too bad we don't talk about that more. Share our visions, share our dreams, which
my
again
mind came true, so that's why I believe it.
Yeah, right. And they can be a
at the time you don't realize that's what it is, but then mm-hmm. it comes to pass, then you go back and
you go,
you know, it's really true.
Yeah, now there's a very interesting connection between past, present, and future. You know, and sometimes our spirit is attuned at a level, I think, that we talk about an intuitive sense. You know, and so we could just, that part of us that's aware at that level, I think, can we can know about a situation that's coming up, and we can know sort of at a deep intuitive level how a person might respond or how the situation might unfold. And I think that's maybe another way to understand that, is that particularly in our close relationships. And it'd be an interesting study to see how many, you know, those experiences, if they come out of, you know, knowing someone deeply. And my guess is that probably happens more often. Interesting. So eternal moments, it talks about, and just to add that the dream stuff, you know, just sharing dreams with close partner, it would be a good practice. Eating, wholesome appetites. He says, as any recovering addict can testify, no amount of food, alcohol, sex, or money will fill an existential void, or that hunger we all have deep within us. We can never get enough of what we didn't want in the first place. You know, a famous line in the addiction language, but it points to this craving part of our spirit, this movement back towards God, and that depth of compassion and support, and how we get caught up in unwholesome appetites and chasing things that just aren't going to do it for us. And often get in a, you know, froth or frenzy until, if we're attending our spirit, we can ask, you know, what do I really want? What am I really after? And if we're open to these possibilities of love, support, deeper connection with God, then often that is part of the answer to that. And we all do this at different times in different ways. So it talks about thanksgiving, gratitude, and generosity. Notice that the more you become a connoisseur of gratitude, the less you are the victim of resentment, depression, and despair. Gratitude will act as an elixir that will gradually dissolve the hard shell of our egos, our need to possess and control, and transform us into a generous being. The sense of gratitude produces true spiritual alchemy, makes us magnanimous, large-souled, is his phrase. One psychologist, woman psychologist, follower of Freud, talks about the two basic approaches to life, one of envy, the cup is half full, and the other or half empty, the other of gratitude, where the cup is half full. And I think both those awarenesses you know, are part of life, but to practice gratitude or counting our blessings, as we say traditionally, is something that actually does something good physiologically to us, and will then remind us as we connect with that of the blessings we're given, which again has that empowering effect to do the giving and caring for work that's so much a part of close relationships. Table talk and soul conversation says soul grows in communion, word by word, story by story, for better or worse. We build our world from true conversation, speaking and listening. Communication deepens into compassion and creates community. Often couples will say, you know, well, what do you want to work on and what's been happening? And they say, well, we're not communicating very well. We have a communication problem. And they listen okay, they understand the English language, you know, together, developing enough time to really connect on a soulful level is often what part of the problem is about. And often that is avoided because there's things there that may be, not just difficult to share in the relationship, but if we're communicating on a soul level, then we're sharing at our depths, and sometimes that, as some clients I work with say, when I talk about it, it makes it more real. And these are often people who have been severely traumatized in their life, and to talk through and to process that makes it more real, and enter a more enlivened place around all that hurt and all that sorrow. And we respect that that's a very difficult place to be and to get at. But in our close relationships, that's where the soul connecting would be. Not just with the hurts, because it can also be very positive experiences also, but it's that depth of feeling that comes across. He talks about the daily news and the practice of compassion. He says sometimes we just want to blank out all the stuff coming at us. But he's working his life to move towards that. And let the practice of compassion, that is letting ourselves really feel for the victims in Rwanda, starvation victims, the victims of violence, rather than depleting us in this certain way that he's talking about, he can help us practice the flowing of divine compassion coming through us. That's kind of his model, is us as vehicles or conduits of that divine compassion. And if we do it with strangers, then we're going to be more likely to do it with those close to us, which paradoxically sometimes is the harder challenge. See, how do we maintain a somewhat uncluttered conduit of compassion? Let's see, what else he's got? Strangers, angels and teachers in disguise. Enter each day with the expectation that the happenings of the day may contain a clandestine message addressed to you personally. Expect omens, epiphanies, casual blessings, and teachers who unknowingly speak to your condition. We like to plan our education and that sort of a thing. But there's a business of being open to surprising learnings. Oh, here's a good one. You'll recognize this. Metanoia, re-owning shadow and radiance. Here he says the projection of the shadow of evil, meaning all the stuff that we identify as negative feelings, hatred, anger, rejection, criticism, disdain, all those things, is woven particularly deeply into the rule of political life. Metanoia, turning around to face the darkness within self, reclaiming our projections, and repenting of our self-righteousness, is an ongoing discipline of the spiritual life. If I really am upset with Chris, or there's a few characteristics she knows that I sort of bring up repeatedly, well, I'm projecting my shadow onto her, you see. She has these characteristics, definitely. But my problem is with my own tendency or say, disowned desire to act in a way that I'm criticizing. And so that's another another way to work with that spiritually. Say, what really bothers me or what irritates me about my partner is to say, okay, what's going on with me? What am I projecting onto them? And this is, of course, apart from things that need to be, you know, solved and confronted, etc. But those chronic patterns is where it will lead us back to an examination of our own tendencies. So again, a dangerous thing in close relationships when it's confronted with that. The practice of metanoia, as we know, or of transformation, involves a gradual disarming of the personality. The best reason to love our enemies is that they hold up a mirror in which we may see the reflection of our disowned self. Our enemies hold the secret, the missing dark treasure that we need to become whole and true. This is a hard one to grasp, but this certainly comes up in close relationships. We're drawn towards, as we said a couple sessions ago, towards that contrasting personality, and yet that will also contain what we call unknown parts of ourself. If we grow up and had inner promises that we'd always be nice and never aggressive, perhaps we might have connected with an aggressive person who has the freedom to be aggressive and may need, you know, in their own selves to learn to manage that better. But being closely connected to that person will draw us to deal with our own aggressiveness and what we've done to that in our development. Let's see, we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, quote unquote. If I translated this into existential language, this was interesting, I would say something like, I'm so frequently encapsulated within my depressed or inflated images of myself that I neglect to explore and enjoy the marvel of life. I am wider and wilder, more capacious and fuller of promise than I dare to be. I live alternately in a flop house and in a luxury hotel, but I do not take possession of the legacy of the overwhelming, overflowing life within which I live and move and have my being. So here's what he's saying, not just the projection of our shadow, but he talks about our own radiance and our own giftedness as the other part of metanoia or transformation. What gifts are we hiding under a bushel, or are we suppressing within ourselves? In spiritual reflection, we'll keep reminding us of that. And again, as we see ourself and others through the eye of God, that's what God sees in us. And to reflect on that and let that message come through on a regular basis we'll continue our walk towards spiritual wholeness. Ooh, a nice chime. Does that mean more? Oh, no, we had a little time. Okay, well, those are some of the ideas that Sam Keen offers, and again, these are things we can do individually that give rise then to sharing or conversation in our close relationships. Also, I think this also gives us an opportunity to appreciate that in any close relationship, you have the two partners. And you also have God there as part of the Trinity. Someone has said that all relationships are triangles, and in a given relationship, you'll have the two partners and work or mistress or the children, as you're saying, who can replace that depth dimension of the relationship, or an addiction, or different things. But I think one way to keep us oriented on the spiritual aspect is to see God certainly as the other aspect of the relationship, calling both persons towards a depth and a resourcing spiritually that leads to healthier, more loving relationship within the relationship itself and relating. Okay, any other questions or concerns about that? We mentioned prayer earlier, and I brought all these books up, so I have to keep showing them to you. Got two. Just actually have one shopping bag, and these bags are really good, by the way. Everybody shop at Nordstrom. these are really good bags. They've come all the way from Portland with us. So, but this is another excellent resource that I've enjoyed and passed on to a lot of people. It's called Primary Speech, A Psychology of Prayer, and it picks up the side of prayer in which there's different kinds of prayer. The Jesus prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy upon us, which reminds us of God's presence in our life and all that we do. And this kind of prayer would be a more expressive or even dialogical prayer. It is where we have a soul conversation with God, basically. And I wanted to just read her description about this, see what you thought of this. Prayer is primary because this speech of confession comes first in any act of praying. Whether we know it or not, in prayer we speak out of our flesh, the ground of our experience, collecting into awareness what our self is saying, both what we know and what we do not know. Augustine says that our prayers have a voice of their own, quite apart from our own voice. God hears all the voices that speak out of us, our vocal prayer, the prayer said in our minds, the unvoiced longing rising from our hearts, the many voices of which we are not conscious, but which cry out eloquently. The God to whom we pray came to us in the flesh and speaks to us now in the flesh of our human self and our world. And even if we do not pray to the God of Scripture or traditional religion, still every time we call for help or understanding from forces beyond us, we pray for something that one way or another seems to respond to us in terms of our humanity. Prayer's first act of confession is the discovery of this primary speech. We begin to hear the self we actually are emerging out of our shadow selves, our counterfeit selves, our pretended selves. We become aware of what it is in us, the best and the worst. Our best parts, if left unlived, can be as poisonous as our worst if left unhealed. In this first act of collecting and recollecting, we discover the fine impulses we fail to act upon, the kind words we left unsaid, the ambitions we left undared. As we discover our worst sides, our envies of others, successes, our reluctance to give, our refusal to be fully present to others, our many large greeds, above all, we discover our fears, the fear to risk, to love, to submit, the fear to lead, to stand out and be seen. We have no nerve of failure, so we play it safe and live in the shadows rather than the light. And her point is that primary speech prayer will be another way that we see ourselves as we express those deeper feelings. If we can let ourselves go in prayer and speak all that is in our minds and hearts, if we can sit quietly and bear the silence, we will hear all the bits and pieces of ourselves crowding in on us, pleading for our attention. Prayer's confession begins with this racket, for prayer is noisy with the clamor of all the parts of us demanding to be heard. The clamor is the sound of the great river of being flowing in us. This is what depth psychologists call primary process thinking, that level of our psyche's functioning that leads straight to the workings of our soul. And sometimes we'll share that with someone, but often we won't. We'll just know it in ourself, and pay attention to it, is what she's saying here. Primary speech. She goes on with chapters on prayer and desire, prayer and projection, fantasy and prayer, living with fantasy, fear and prayer and aggression, sexuality and prayer, praying for others, answers to prayer. It's pretty interesting resource. Well, this tape is not going to have music, it's going to have chimes on it. So, hope you haven't lost my voice through this. Okay, well, those are some of the resources I wanted to share today and talk about. And again, this is an area that is we don't often talk about or share about, but I hope we've covered some things that have been interesting and resourceful to you. And certainly, as I pray for the energy and the conviction to keep at relationship work, I realize that's and hope for your relationships too, that we would continue to resource ourselves spiritually as the source of our being compassionate people.